I say to myself, excellent. I must be ready to step up, because if this opportunity is in front of me now, I must be ready for it. So good that you're nervous. That's great. That means you're going to try that bit harder, but step up and make it happen. So if you see an opportunity and you're recognizing it's there, then great. If you'll recognize it, you must have the skills to do something with it.
Welcome to The Gloaming, everyone. Today we're talking to Corinne Armour about leadership and vulnerability.
Angelo.
Hey, James.
Hey.
It's good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Back in the shed.
Yeah, back in the shed down in Warragul.
Where it all happens.
This is the production house of The Gloaming podcast.
I'm sure there's people out there wondering, I'm being conceited again, James. They're out there wondering, well, you know, where are these people? And, you know, what does it look like we're in that room? And, you know, and they're having these wonderful conversations. Do you want to describe it, James? Maybe for our, you know, our very interested listeners.
I'm just not sure that anyone's interested. I think they're going to be much more interested in our guest today.
That's right. Our guest today, Corinne Armour, who is a thought leader, passionate about supporting leaders, teams and organisations to reduce wasted human potential, James. And we did talk a little bit about that, which was actually really apt right at the end, wasn't it? Don't you think?
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, Corinne's mission is really to empower leaders and teams through fearless leadership. And fearless leadership is something that she talks about that allows individuals to reach their career potential, enable teams to get unstuck and fulfill their goals. And she talks about helping people get out of their own way so that they can, you know, fulfill their potential. She's written a couple of books. She's a Gippsland girl, which is
yeah,
great.
She is. We hook this all back to Gippsland because there is untapped potential. And, you know, like in a lot of the conversations that we've had so far, you know, these are leaders, you know, maybe at a smaller plus scale, but who are doing amazing things. But outside of these conversations we've had, you know, outside of the recorded conversations, we've had some interactions with other people who also have visions, who don't really consider themselves to be leaders as such, and maybe getting in their own way a little bit. So we're hoping they'll tune in and have a listen to Corinne and what she's got to say as to how to sort of unleash their potential.
Excellent. Why don't we just get stuck into it, James?
Let's talk to Corinne.
So my name's Corinne Armour, and when I think about who I am, I'm very much a Gippsland girl. Gippsland's very much part of my identity. So I grew up on a farm on the Warragul side of the Strzelecki's, apple orchard and a dairy farm. And I think about the childhood I had and how I just ran free, and I had a horse and guinea pigs and dogs and cats and, you know, all the things that kids who grow up on farms have. Mm. And it was just a fabulous lifestyle. So I still, and my family is still there. And interesting, this is the first time I've sort of had this conversation in this current period of my life, and the current period of my life being my parents have just bought land in town, mm-hmm. and are building a house. And so sometime in the next 12 months to 2 years, they will leave the farm and move into town. And I'm actually struggling a bit with that because I know it's there right now, and I don't get there that often, but I can go there anytime. But when they move into town, that bit of Gippsland, I've got two bits of Gippsland, but the bit that's perhaps the most important to me is not quite so accessible. And so I've just noticed just in the last 2 weeks, I've started to think about the impact that that's having on my sense of where I come from. And I have my husband and I built a house on the 90 Mile Beach about 15 years ago, and I've actually just come back from a couple of days there. So I still spend a lot of time I've got my own part of Gippsland, but it's not the same as the part I grew up
in. It's not quite the rolling green hills.
No, it's not the rolling green hills of West Gippsland. It's sort of the beaches of sort of central South Gippsland, which are still incredibly beautiful, I have to say. So that's my connection to Gippsland. And then how did I get to where I am? Well, where I am now is a leadership specialist. So I help leaders and teams develop fearless leadership. And there's lots of really complicated ways, you know, very fancy ways of explaining that. But really, it's about leaders and teams getting out of their own way. And So how did I go from Gippsland to here? Well, I did a science degree because no one in my family at that point had been to university, and I was good at science, and I went to a girls' school and they thought that I should do science. So I did that, and then at the end of that thought, well, that was interesting, but that wasn't really what I wanted to do. So then I did postgrad marketing and moved into marketing and did that for 10 years or so, and then got to the point where I thought my whole life until that point had been directed at me. My parents worked really hard. They gave up a lot so that I could have a good education. I went to university, got a lovely job, got the annual promotion, you know, nice car, nice clothes, all those sorts of things. And I thought, if I choose that consciously, that's okay. But I hadn't really chosen it. I'd just taken the next step each time and ended up there. So I went to Southeast Asia. The idea was 6 months in Asia and 6 months in Africa. And I still haven't been to Africa. And spent 2.5 years in Southeast Asia, and most of that in a refugee camp on the edge of a war zone on the Thai-Burmese border. And that, so I don't know so much that it changed. It did change me, but it also brought out a lot of what was important and made me forget a lot of things that weren't important. So when I came back to Australia, there's no way I could go back to marketing, like selling things to people that they didn't want and probably couldn't afford. So so I got into banking and spent, yeah, not such a great place to be right now.
Very topical, yeah. Isn't it?
Very topical, you know, right now. It's like, don't mention
relative terms, it's the lesser evil, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Unless you're marketing in a bank. Yeah. Now, that could be. And so I did that for more than 15 years, but that took me on the journey of an amazing personal and professional journey that ANZ at the time was taking a major cultural transformation, and it got me exposed to a lot of amazing concepts and amazing people. And that's when I learned about coaching and realized that coaching, I'd always thought about myself as a bit of a lazy leader, because I didn't feel the need to have all the answers or the need to do everything or control everything. And I always wondered if that was a bit of a character flaw as a leader. But when I came across this idea of coaching as a leadership style back in the early times of coaching, where at that point the only people who ever coached were football coaches, and that got me thinking about perhaps this is a way that I can be more useful. And so it led me eventually to leave the corporate world about 10 years ago and focus on leadership development. And so that's what I do now.
So tell us a little bit about what is coaching? I mean, in the context of the work that you do, you know, everybody hears the word coach and it conjures up images of, you know, ex-star football players, you know, in their trackies looking a little bit less fit than what they were in their prime, and, you know, and having these motivational speeches to the guys to get them out in the field and, you know, bowl everyone over and you know, win one for the big V or something like that. What is coaching in this context of working with, you know, professionals and in a corporate environment?
Oh, Ange, I can't get past the image you've just created. Like, everyone thinks about coaching like that. My God, you've just changed my whole perception about when I introduce myself. What are people going to be thinking about me? So what is coaching? Coaching comes from the premise, in a developmental sense rather than perhaps in a sporting sense, coaching comes from the premise that the client has what they need. They've got an inner knowledge. And so coaching is very much about challenging and supporting. So I say to clients, teams and individuals, if you want to work with me, you can guarantee that I'll always be in your corner. But you can also guarantee that sometimes it's not going to feel like that, that you're going to think, oh, she's pushing us too hard or too fast, or I don't want to go there. So that's that balance between support and challenge, and helping people to be the best version of themselves. And so because I work in the leadership space, it's about helping leaders and helping teams be the best versions of themselves that they can.
So on the flip side, what is I guess it's kind of the flip side anyway. What's a boss?
So I think a boss, the best bosses have elements of coaching in their style. And so I think about that as a leader who asks. So the leader who tells says, all right, James, you need to do this and you need to do it this way and you need to do it by this time. Mm. Whereas a leader who asks will say, well, here's the broad parameters, James. How do you think you might approach it? What might you do next? What have you done in the past that's going to prepare you to do this now? What help do you need? So that's more of a coaching style. So I think the best bosses, while they're not coaches, because there are times when you absolutely must tell, you know, you must direct, but the best bosses know when to direct, when to coach, when to show, when to train, and can use all of those styles.
So tell us a little bit about, I know you've got a book that's just been released, and you've used the language already. So Leaders Who Ask is what it's called.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about there's a notion that I know that you put forward to a lot of the people you work with, this idea of fearless leadership. What does it mean when you're teaching people this idea of fearless leadership?
Okay, so fearless leadership is an aspiration rather than an end point. And so it's about approaching that. And for me, it's about fearing less rather than being fearless, because really the only time you're ever going to be completely fearless is either when you're dead or dead drunk. And neither of those are useful for leadership. So it's about, you know, recognizing where there's fear as an individual and using it as data. It's about where there's when you're talking about a leadership team, where's the fear and how's that playing out in our behavior? How's that playing out in our relationships? And what do we need to do to work through that? So it's not so much an absence of fear. It's more about making the decisions that need to be made, having the conversations that need to be had, and doing that in a way that builds the relationships between us rather than bruises it. So I think about it as, from an individual perspective, it's about courage, curiosity, and compassion. And when you can be courageous and have compassion for yourself and other people and be curious about, you know, what am I doing? What are they doing? What's the outcome we're looking for here? Then that takes you towards being fearless.
So can you give us an example? I mean, you work with a lot of people and you have a lot of conversations and you've got, I'm sure, you know, 101 stories about examples of leaders getting to that point of having to choose to be fearless, as you've just described, and then either, you know, jumping in and doing it or maybe just not, you know, not being able to get over the line. Can you give stories without names and places and anything else like that? But tell us a story about a situation where somebody that you know that you've worked with has got to that point and had to just dive in, and did they dive in, and what was the outcome?
Yeah, so a really recent example, working with a bloke who has senior leader and very talented and has been given a battery of tests and 360 feedback. And so 360 feedback, for anyone who's not familiar in the listening audience, is where you get feedback from the people above you, beside you, and below you in the organization. So this guy's got a lot of feedback saying that he doesn't care about people, that he only cares about the outcome, so people feel like they're being used, and that he's directive the whole time and doesn't take a coaching approach and is not developing his people, is disempowering them. So this feedback was a massive shock for him, because he knows he's very, very task focused, very goal orientated. And yet the thing that hurt him most is that people think he doesn't care. So we had a conversation about, okay, well, we've got that feedback. What are we going to do with it? And so what he wanted to do was bring his team together, give them a little bit of a sense of, here's the feedback I've got and here's what I'm going to do with it. But he wanted to do it in a really clean, easy, sanitized way. And I said, that's a waste of time, because they're not going to feel like you're taking it seriously. You need to be vulnerable. You need to actually say, I got this feedback. Here's some of the headlines. It really hurt. You know, and it hurt me because what I'm trying to be is this, and yet what I realized is that. And I know, when I can think of examples, you know, you've told me that I'm being too specific, that I'm being too aggressive in my timeframes, and I can think of examples, and here's one from yesterday. And now I've heard that, here's what I'm going to do instead. And he said, oh, I had something like that many years ago in my career and it went really badly, and I don't think I can do that again. and he looked frightened, like physically frightened. Colour dropping from his face. And I said to him, okay, then, you know, that's a choice that you can make, but this is really important. And you're going to look back on this time in your career and think that's a turning point. And so there was silence and there was lots of thinking going on. And then he said, all right, will you help me work out how to do it? And so we worked out a bit of an approach that he was going to take. It was all prepared for it. And I sent him a text that morning. And I said, I hope it goes well. And yep, I hope it goes well too. And then someone was sick and it was cancelled. So it didn't happen till another week and a half later. And he was just on a massive high afterwards. Everybody responded. They were all amazed. They all came up to him individually afterwards and said how much courage it must have taken to put yourself out on the line like that. And we really want to help you. And now that we've seen that side of you, you know, we think you can be successful. This guy reports to the executive. So the executive team are noticing the difference. He's noticing the difference. The team's noticing the difference. So that's just one little example of how much courage it can take to be vulnerable. I think Brené Brown, who you might have heard of, just published her most recent book called Daring Greatly, which I haven't read yet. I've
actually read it. My mum bought it for me.
Oh, brilliant.
It's not something I normally read, but she bought it for me and it was a great book. And she's done a TED talk too, which was same theme. So
in her Lotus research, what she's saying is, I believed that what leaders needed was more courage, and they needed more courage so that they could be vulnerable. And what I've uncovered in my research is that leaders are frightened every day and they work through that. So they've got courage, but what they put up is armor between themselves and the world to keep them safe, and particularly to keep them safe from being vulnerable. So they'll make really courageous, gutsy decisions on risking the organization or perhaps even risking their careers, but risking breaking down their armor and risking being vulnerable is something that people really struggle with.
So is that, when we look at leaders, is that kind of what we, like, what, why is it that we kind of almost want to see that? We want to see that element of vulnerability. Is it the relatability that sort of allows to break down the barriers, or what's that? What is?
I think it is. It's about the relatability. It's about that you're not perfect. It's that you're human. I mean, even James, it goes back to what we were saying before we started recording, when I said, "No, my 12-year-old, my year old might burst in and talk about daddy's making me do cello practice." And you said, oh, well, that'll show us the breadth of what you do and that you're human. So it's an element of humanness, because the current research from a neuroscience perspective, so a lot of what I do is informed by neuroscience, so how's the brain responding to what we do, that the human need for connection is one of our greatest needs. And so when I can genuinely connect with my leader, then I'm willing to do anything. So yeah. I think this vulnerability is about connection. And if you're perfect, James, and I'm reporting to you, then there's not much space for me. Hmm. Whereas if you're not perfect, if there are things you don't know or things you can't handle, then we can do it together. So then there's a place for me to step in and offer whatever it is that I can bring.
I just think about sort of has it changed? Because I think about, especially during troubled times where, you know, there's these archetypal leaders that kind of get up in front of all these people and they look like they're just, you know, their veins are filled with, you know, thunder and lightning. There's not even a little chink in their armor. And that's what kind of motivates people and encourages and, you know, gives them hope that there's going to be, you know, a good outcome. They're going to be able to get through, you know. Is that changed? Is it that style of leadership for that kind of situation, or I don't know. I find it really strange that the archetypal old school leader, the stories that we hear about these fantastic leaders are very different models to what we're talking about right now.
And I think there's two things. One is, overall, it has changed. So there was a gold standard leader that was strong. I mean, even when I started working, so I'm 52, When I first started working, my boss gave the instructions and we did what we were told. And my aspirational goal was to get to the point where I would know everything and tell everyone what to do.
Mm.
And to some extent, even 30 years ago, it was more possible to know everything. Whereas now the interconnectedness of what we do is greater. Things are so complex that no one person can have the answers, which is why I'm so passionate about working with leadership teams, because when you've got a team working really well, then you've got multiple perspectives and you're much more able to solve things. So I think our environment has changed and our expectation has changed with that. I think there's also something about, you said, is it the situation we're in? And, yeah, maybe we're a bit frightened about the future. Maybe it's complex. Maybe we're worried about our jobs. Maybe we're worried about globalization. But we're relatively safe. We're not in a major conflict situation. And perhaps if that were the case, we would want someone who was more of an archetypally stronger leader. But even then, I'm not sure. I think our idea and our notion of what makes a good leader has shifted significantly.
Mm. There's another podcast that I listen to sometimes called, his name's Jocko Willink, and he's a former US Marine. And he sort of does the corporate circuit, or, you know, he sort of talks about leadership, and he fought for quite a few years in Iraq, a few tours of duty, and yeah. he talks about actually that sort of softer side as well. There's a vulnerability which he talks about with his own subordinates, which he has to demonstrate in order for them to have buy-in on the mission, and for them to trust that he's actually got their back, that under the most extreme conditions, that they've got the kind of relationship which, I mean, you know, at that time you don't act just on sort of directives. You act because you care, you care about each other. And and it seems to be from his perspective that mobilizing like a mobilizing force which just sort of like binds the team together and propels them forward.
So that archetypal comment of the band of brothers, I can't even say it, where people connected. My husband Mithane was a guerrilla fighter before I first met him, and so he defected from the Burmese military and joined the civil uprising in 1988 in Burma. So then he was a guerrilla fighter for many years. So they were effectively the volunteers. They had no rations often. They had certainly no salary. Most of them had there was no extra clothes. Like, they had what they had on their backs and that was it. And often they didn't even have enough ammunition. And so the only real leadership tool that Mithane had to keep his group together was a sense of purpose. Mm. And some of them were there because they had strong political beliefs about the importance of democracy. Some of them were there because they'd seen their village torched and their parents killed. Whatever their personal purpose, Mithane's way of bringing them all together, apart from that sort of camaraderie that you're talking about, that sense of love and connection for one another, was actually just around the purpose. Like, what are we here to do? And why is it important? And when you can bring people together on purpose, you can literally have people motivated to put their life on the line every day.
Hmm.
And that's what Mithane did.
So who is a leader and how do they become a leader? And what are the challenges that are faced when, you know, when there's a leadership opportunity for someone to take that role and be a leader? What are the kinds of challenges that are, the average person when they realize they have to take leadership, whether that's an official role or whatever, it's a situation where they need to lead. What's going on in people's heads? What's the, what are the mechanics there when people are thinking about or taking on this role of leader?
Yeah, great question. I was reflecting on this in advance of our conversation. And I was actually thinking about this in the context of community leadership. So someone stepping forward and leading in their community. And so the value of community is very strong for me. And so I was thinking about that as the lens of the broader question of what's going through the minds of people, what is it when they're stepping forward. But I realised that they're probably having answered it through the lens of community leadership, it's probably the same answer, even if I were thinking about a more professional setting or a corporate setting. But self-doubt is very much the first thing that comes into the mind of most people. You know, do I have the experience? Do I have the credibility? Do I have the strength? Do I have the skills? And will people follow me? So I think self-doubt, and for some people that self-doubt becomes really a hard thing to carry. It drains energy. For others, it's more of an honest questioning of themselves. You know, do I have what it takes? I think there's also something about a gap. Like a gap appears, and then we think, is that gap a match for my expertise? Is it a gap for? Is it a match for my values and where I want to go? So it might be a gap because somebody leaves a position, or it might be just a gap that opens up. And I was thinking about the 2009 fires, and I was approached, it must have been early 2010, to facilitate a leadership program for women who had stepped into predominantly informal leadership roles post the 2009 fires. So in the immediate days, weeks and months after their communities were so badly damaged by fire. And so we had a couple of days at a beautiful place in the Yarra Valley. And for some women, it was the first time they'd actually slept in a bed, you know, rather than just being in a camp stretcher or in a hut or a tent or a caravan. But what was really interesting about that is that so many of them didn't see themselves as leaders, even though they'd been nominated by their communities to be at that program. And some of them realized that they'd stepped into leadership roles when they were nominated. And they made the decision to opt in, yes, I'll go on that program. But there were some who didn't really believe it until we'd been working together for a couple of days on what is a leader and what does it take. And they were saying things to me, well, like, you know, I'm not a leader. I just did what needed to happen. Mm. And there was a gap, there was a need, and so I stepped in and filled it. So I think there's definitely something about the need, and then there's the, you know, who are your who's advocating for you, who's supporting you, who's drawing you into that space? Because sometimes we see a space and we step into it, but other times other people see a space and they see something in us that we don't see, and they call us forward to step into that space.
It's so interesting that, like, I love that description, that story you just told, because it sort of, you know, exemplifies this sort of humility that I see in some of my sort of, you know, historical heroes, like Martin Luther King, who was never touted as much of a leader until such time as just that gap opened up in the situation, and he happened to be there, and no one else was coming forward. And he just happened to take a couple of steps forward. Everybody followed, and then as a result, the civil rights movement. You know, and I'm wondering to what degree that humility that is required for leadership, and why that might be necessary.
Mm. I think that's a really interesting question, because there are definitely leaders who have great humility, and then there are others that are, you know, unashamedly self-promoting. Mm. But I think when they're self-promoting to move themselves forward, it becomes evident fairly quickly.
It's obvious. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas when they're self-promoting because they're the front face of a cause, then I think that comes across quite differently. So I can think of a couple of leaders that I know, particularly in the community sector, who are often spokespeople, who are in the media, who are very very out there. And when you talk to them, they're still very humble. But they're happy to be the face, because somebody needs to be, and that takes the cause forward. And I had a conversation with a woman today, an interview actually with a woman today I'm interviewing for a role on my team currently. And we were talking about her experience with social media, which is fine. And then we were talking about whether she likes working with social media. And she said, I don't want to be the person who's promoting myself, but I'm very happy to be the person who's promoting somebody else if it's for a good cause. And that was where my mind went initially when you asked that question.
Yeah. And there's kind of, it feels to me like there's a dovetail with your book, Leaders Who Ask. There's a degree of humility that it takes, right, to be able to put yourself in the position where you actually say, you're genuinely saying, like, I don't actually know the answer to this question. Here's the question, though, and I kind of anticipate that you might rise to the challenge.
Or maybe we both don't know, but we can work it out together. I think there's something very, very connecting about questions. Judith Glaser, who has created the concept of conversational intelligence, which is built very much on current thinking and neuroscience. She talks about the power for leaders to ask questions for which they have no answers. So when I'm asking you questions and I know the answer, and you probably know that I know the answer, so then you know there must be a right answer. So then you're searching for the right answer. You're really not thinking about it. Whereas when I ask a question that neither of us have the answer for, then that opens the space for a whole new level of conversation.
It kind of unleashes creativity at that point, right? If there's no right answer, that's when all the faculties are called forth.
Exactly.
I'm interested, because I mean, obviously Gippsland, I guess the premise of our podcast is really about the uncertainty in the future and trying to find ways to navigate that uncertainty when you don't exactly know what is coming. What's the role of leadership when there is such uncertainty? What sorts of qualities do they need to have or conjure in their communities in order to meet that challenge?
They need to be able to build trust. One of our human needs is certainty. And so an absence of certainty, so uncertainty, triggers a threat response in the brain. So the part of the brain that looks for error detection sees that uncertainty, and it's almost like this bing, 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 these warning bells of, you know, look out, look out, look out. There's things that we don't know here. There's danger here. And so extreme uncertainty can create an amygdala response, so a very heightened response in the brain. If I am in the presence of a leader I trust, then that anxiety in the brain is lessened. So when I'm in the presence of someone I trust, then dopamine's released, and dopamine's a happy chemical. It's creative, and oxytocin, which is the connection neurotransmitter. So in uncertainty, I can give you messages that lead to extreme uncertainty. And if you trust me, there's a sense of trust between us, then you'll take those messages and we'll be able to work through it together. And you'll still have your creative faculties about you. Whereas if you don't trust me and I give you those messages that make you realize the extent of the uncertainty, then you can go into meltdown. Then you go into a defense response. Your creativity shuts down. You move into a flight, fight, freeze response in its most extreme. So there's lots of other things a leader needs, but the very first thing is the ability to create trust between people.
Let's talk about that more specifically, especially in the context of leadership in our community in Gippsland. So, you know, what are the kinds of things that, if we were to go out there and provide a 360 to our current leaders in the community, what are the sort of things that we should be telling them to think about in how they could develop more trust with us as the constituents, as the citizens in this community?
I think some vulnerability. So the sorts of things that we were just talking about there, and honesty. So Australians have very good bullshit detectors. Mm. So if you're trying to spin a story, you know, Australians can pick it up really fast. Mm. So those are things that lack of honesty and spinning stories break down trust. For example, if we were thinking about something significant that's happening in the community, for our community leaders to be saying, well, this is the direction we're going in, if they know. But if they don't know yet, then tell us what you do know, but tell us also where the gaps are. Tell us where, when you're going to give us an update. So if it's, all right, where are we now? Mid-October. So by the 1st of November, we should have an understanding of what will happen next. So we'll come back to the community on the 1st of November and we'll give everybody an update. Then you must honour that. Because if you do, the expectation of an update and then the provision of an update, that gives everybody a dopamine hit. So we all feel a bit better about it.
Certainty leads to more trust and leads to
exactly.
a more productive environment, right?
Exactly. So we want the lack of bullshit. We want honesty. We want updates and certainty when we can. I think people want to know that their needs are being considered. I don't think people always expect their needs to be met, but they want their needs to be heard. So real forums, and some of my colleagues who work in that community consultation phase, and they talk about, oh, this is a client. They'll say to me, oh, I'm working with such and such a council, or I'm working with so-and-so a group. They believe in real consultation. So what they mean by that is if they're brought in, they're actually having, they're facilitating good consultation conversations between whatever the organisation is and the community. And there's an expectation and understanding that there's listening, and then those ideas will be fed back into decision-making and policy development. Or then there's the organisations that do, you know, pretend consultancy. Okay, right, we're going to go and ask the community what they say, and then we're going to come back and we're doing what we're doing anyway.
Yeah.
Or there's so many slides about the future in the consultation that you think this isn't a consultation, this is a communication session. So I think all of those things are important.
It's funny because I think about it in the political context and, you know, the current sort of political environment that we're in. You know, I can't imagine.
You're not looking there for inspiration, are you?
No, well, I guess, you know, they're you know, functional and formal roles, leadership roles in our community that we all can identify. But I don't think I can remember, you know, in any recent times, a political leader getting up in front of, you know, in front of the world in the media saying, I don't know what the answer is. We're still figuring it out. And you know what? And we'll ask a couple of people and we'll ask you and then we'll get back to you in a month's time. It's almost, you know, and I know in certain roles that I've had in different organizations that, you know, there's almost a fear to say that we don't know what's going on, to be able to go out and say officially, we have a functional, you know, leadership role as X, as this person in this organization. And there's no way we're going to go out into the community and say, hey, we don't know what's going on yet. We're still figuring it out. And, you know, we'll talk to more people, come back to you in a month. So it's so funny to, you know, I totally get it. It makes total sense to me in terms of the way you'd approach leadership, maybe in an organization with an individual. But that challenge is whether, you know, you've got a community leadership role or a political leadership role, why do people feel like they have to have all the answers sometimes, and that it's a sign of weakness, or the other side will just find that little chink in the armor and then dig away? So it just creates this environment where, you know, artificially we have to put out this image of everything's fine, we know what we're doing, we're going there, and this is what it's going to be, and, you know, off we go. I find it really fascinating.
So is that a myth, Corinne? Like, is that sort of sense of certainty that you have to have an answer for everything in order to be a good leader? Is that a myth?
I think it is a myth, and I think it's something that we're in transition with. I think there are many leaders now who will say, I don't have all the answers. You know, that's why I've got this team around me, or, you know, we even don't have all the answers. But there are still many who think that they need them.
Mm.
And I think, Ange, when you were talking about the political situation, we have such an adversarial political situation. Mm-hmm. It's not like you put some ideas forward and we can build on it. We're in a, you know, you put some ideas forward, I need to tear them down, at least for now. Mm-hmm. And then I need to put some other ideas in place. And, you know, I struggle a bit with our democratic process, and my husband gave up his life, or almost gave up his life, you know, to achieve democracy. And I think it's better than alternatives that I have lived in. Mm. But we've still got a long way to go too.
So that actually, I mean, this could be a bit of a tangent, but I'm really interested at the moment in that sort of that political climate, which is so incredibly polarized, and I think it's more polarized in other parts of the world than it is here in our own country. But what sort of leadership needs to rise in that atmosphere in order to break the deadlock, in order to continue the productive conversations that move us forward?
So from a neuroscience perspective, we have a term there, our in-group and our out-group. Mm. And so from an evolutionary perspective, I need to make a really quick assessment. Are you with me or against me? Are you like me or unlike me? Are you going to help me survive, or are you going to bring my downfall? And so the more we can expand our in-group, then the more different perspectives we can take in. And so what I see, you know, in other parts of the world in particular, without naming any, is at the moment is very much this is us. You're either with us or against us. And so they're really exploiting this, it's our camp or it's their camp. Hmm. And to break that down, we need to start looking for where's the commonalities. Like I heard someone, I can't remember who, it was a really interesting interview, might have even been a little bit of an aside on a podcast a week or so ago, talking about the really different political perspectives at the moment in the US on whether or not Judge Kavanaugh is an appropriate appointment.
Mm-hmm. Pretty controversial.
And very controversial. Mm-hmm. And this person was saying, whether you talk to this side or that side, the views are so strong and they're so clear down party lines, mm. which is not that surprising. But what I thought was really interesting, which is the next comment, was, and they genuinely cannot see why the other group can't see it.
Mm. It's so, such a fascinating phenomenon. And also terrifying, because I've been sort of puzzling around, you know, and I'm really interested in community conversations. We're both interested in community conversations, and you know, we don't have anywhere near the level of polarization that's happening in the US at the moment, but we've got little local issues that are bubbling away that people have their strong opinions about on either side. And you know, oftentimes, you know, you kind of inquire and you try to see, is there any light, is there any crack there through which they're able to see the light coming from the other side? Like, is there anything there that you would award a little bit of credit to? I mean, what does it take to open up that conversation where you're actually able to, I mean, I know that we humans can be tribal by nature, in some sense, but you know, the last 300 years of the Enlightenment have opened up the possibility of a reasonable discussion. You know, what does it take to sort of bring us away from the precipice of sort of, you know, that extreme, to back to kind of like, hey, maybe we do have some common ground here. Maybe there's something we can discover.
I'm going into more conjecture now, James, because my space is not those massive, big, polarized conversations, and not really the massive, big community polarized conversations either. Although there are times when I work with executive teams where it feels like that. I think the principles are the same. It's about asking questions that get people thinking. Mm. And starting with and something I missed when you talked before about what should, if we were talking to our leaders across Gippsland, what would we be saying to them that's important? I think vision, like having a vision, not necessarily a this is how it will be, but having a vision is critical. So if we go back to these sides that aren't seeing that aren't seeing the even the smallest possible merit in the other one's argument is, well, what's our overarching vision? Because usually if we're down at this level of detail, we disagree. But eventually we can chunk up to high enough level of abstraction that we get an agreement. So the agreement might be we want a healthy, thriving Gippsland, for example, or a healthy, thriving Moe, or, a street in Moe or wherever we are. And so going back up to that level of abstraction where we can all agree, and then coming back down again to what would that look like?
Right. Yeah.
Because when we get out of rapport with somebody, we can't influence them. And so we need to work back up to getting into rapport to be able to do that. And having a agreed way of engaging in these conversations is really important. So I do that when I work with executive teams. I do that when I work with any groups. Like, how are we going to play together today? And we don't very often need to go back and say, hey, James, those things on the wall that we said, you're not following them. Just having had the discussion and then having had them on the walls where everyone can see them influences the way we play together. So having those common agreements on, if we're going to have this conversation, how are we going to have it? What's important to us in having this conversation can be a really good place to start.
One of the things that this reminds me of is something that you put forward in your book around the difference between listening for understanding and listening for connection.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that, the differences between those two? Because we've all heard, listening to form that understanding is really important. But I haven't heard this idea of listening for connection. And I think there's a relationship between what we've just been talking about in terms of leaders and in that environment and this idea of listening for connection, and maybe hopefully that's a space where we start to see more than the differences that are separating us.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we tend to do in a conversation is, if we're polite, we listen for a pause so that we can speak in. We don't talk over one another because we're good mannered. So we listen for a pause in the conversation. When we go beyond that, we listen for understanding. So I really want to understand your point of view. But often that's, I want to understand it because I want to know the extent to which it agrees with my point of view. So I want to refute it, or I want to feel comfortable in it, or I want to understand it so I can build on it. It's more transactional. Whereas when we listen to connect, what I'm listening for is to form a real bond with you as another human being or as a group of human beings. And that's much deeper. And so that's about not only listening to the words, but it's listening to the space between the words. It's listening to what's said. It's thinking about, okay, so this is what Angelo said. I wonder what he meant. Now I'm curious about the meaning that sits behind that. So and when you listen to connect, the understanding comes. So we're not putting aside listening for understanding so we can listen to connect. The understanding comes with the connection, but the connection takes it much deeper. And I know that since I've been practicing this as a concept, it's shifted my relationships and it shifted the conversations that I have. And my biggest challenge to this is actually with my 12-year-old daughter, who I love deeply, but who's in that, I know anything and I'm everything and I'm right. And even tonight at dinner, well, yes, I know that because I know I've got overprotective parents who will say no to everything. and I remind myself, okay, this is not listen, because listen to understand or listen to refute would have me jump right back in and say, listen here, young lady, what about on the weekend when we let you? And listen to connect takes me to different places, and it's a work in progress.
That's what we've got to look forward to.
That's James. What we do have to look forward to, both with young kids.
Yes, yes.
Hey, look, one thing that we always try to do is, so you know Gippsland, you're connected to Gippsland. Maybe we just ask you a couple of questions about Gippsland and just tell us what you think, I guess, as someone who's connected to the place and who spends time, across the broad variety of landscapes that we have in this beautiful place. But What do you think of Gippsland as a bit of a stage for leadership for people that are, that, you know, are there gaps? Is there the right kind of support from your perspective for leaders to emerge in this region, especially now when we know that we're dealing with some challenges and, you know, we're in this state of transition. What do you think? How do you see Gippsland as a stage for leadership to emerge?
I think Gippsland's interesting because, you know, if you think about it as a local area, it's relatively small because the land is so fertile when we compare it to, I don't know, a regional equivalent in Western Australia or Central New South Wales, for example. And yet there's so much diversity in that. I think we're in a time where we're thinking both globally and locally. So there's opportunities and fears around globalization. And so what opportunities and challenges does that give us at a local level? And I think that gives us amazing opportunities for the small local things to come back, the things that perhaps we had, you know, 50 years ago that we then went to big mass produced, and now we're going back much more to smaller, more local things. So I think that that's an opportunity. I think, and when I grew up, so I grew up out of Warrigal, all the boys went to tech school, or most of the boys went to tech school, and of that, most of them went off to apprenticeships with the SEC, so as it was then. And of course that progressively over the last 40 years has run down in terms of being a major employment provider. And so that's a major loss to the community, but that's brought about other opportunities. There's been other, you know, state government willing to invest in other things in Gippsland. And I think there are opportunities, but I think it's going to be up to people who can look more broadly and see those opportunities. So I think perhaps, you know, on a really local level, I think about my mother's an amazing inspiration to me. So there's a church in Warrigal, it's now called Wesley of Warrigal, that was becoming run down. It's in the centre of town. It's heritage listed, so something had to happen to it. And my mother and a group of people worked together to raise the funds to buy the church from the physical building, from the church hierarchy, and to renovate it and to turn it into a community art space. So that's just a small example that Warrigal and Gippsland now has an amazing arts venue that it wouldn't have had if a couple of people didn't have this amazing vision and then work hard over many years to make it happen. So there are, I imagine that there are lots of opportunities for that to happen in Gippsland like there is anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're dead right. And we've talked to a few of them over the last few months, those that are operating at a smaller plus scale, but who are doing incredible things, and that there's even more of those who we've talked to, not on air, who I think have the vision. You know, they've got that seed for inspiration for something. It might be just really, really like local to their township, but I'm wondering what would you tell them? What advice would you, would you give them, those who don't perceive themselves to be, you know, leaders, because they conceive of a leader as someone who's in front of a bunch of people and letting loose with a bunch of soaring rhetoric and all of that, but you're talking about it in a different sense. What would you tell them at that in lower level?
I'm thinking about what would I tell myself in that situation. And every now and then I'll have a client come to me with a challenge, like it might be a highly dysfunctional leadership team, or it might be an individual leader, or it might be a massive convention where I've got to stand up in front of thousands of people and I think, oh shit, you know, am I up for this? And I remember what somebody told me when I first started out: you get the clients you're ready for and you get the opportunities that you have the skills to make happen. And so if I ever have that feeling myself, rather than going into, oh my goodness, you know, can I do it? I say to myself, excellent, I must be ready to step up, because if this opportunity is in front of me now, I must be ready for it. So good, good that you're nervous. That's great. That means you're going to try that bit harder, but step up and make it happen.
That's a cool paradigm to bring to the situation. Yeah. I like that.
So if you see an opportunity and you're recognizing it's there, then great. If you'll recognize it, you must have the skills to do something with it.
Right. Geez, that just opens the world up for people, because there's so many people out there who would be in that exact position. You know, I felt that myself. I think there's just instances where you're like, yeah, I could see an opportunity there. I'm not quite up to the task. Well, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of a Canadian clinical psychologist, a doctor, Jordan Peterson. And I heard him speaking just recently about, nobody ever gets rid of the anxiety in situations that are kind of chaotic, where it's the unknown. They don't really know what's coming at them. But he said no one gets rid of that. But those that actually succeed in those situations, they still get rid of it. But what they do is they get comfortable with the idea that they will be anxious, but they'll do it anyway.
That's so true. And one of the privileges that I have of the work that I do is I get inside the hearts and minds of pretty amazing leaders. And I know that people are afraid. Like I know that the person doing amazing things out there that everyone's looking at and thinking, oh, look at that person, you know, they would never be afraid. They would, you know, they would never have a baby throwing up over their shoulders when they're just about to walk into a media interview. You know, their lives are all perfect. And I know that they're not. And I know they go through massive doubt. And so coming back to this idea of fearless, it's not that these leaders are fearless. It's that they feel the fear and then they say, right, you know, onwards and upwards. So, yeah, I think there are very few good leaders who are not, who don't doubt themselves and don't wonder if they're up for it and just go ahead anyway.
And if they're not doubting themselves, then they're the leaders we're worried about.
Yeah, well, then maybe I can think of one who may be in that situation.
Yeah, I think we can too. Very, very senior position in a particular country.
Yeah. So Corinne, you've got your finger on the pulse of leadership, you know, in this country, maybe, you know, more broadly in this little blue-green planet of ours. When you think about the landscape of leadership in Australia, or, you know, within the view that you've got visibility of, is there anything that really annoys you where you think, why is this happening? Why are leaders doing this? Why does it keep popping up? Is there anything that you see in almost despair and say, come on, guys, you've got to be able to get over that?
Yeah. It's waste.
Waste. Talk to us about that.
So my big word, the word that governs, you know, inspires who I am and what I do, is potential, and helping individuals and teams and organizations and communities fulfill their potential. And I see so much waste, whether it's something administrative, like my phone bill is wrong again, and it's so significantly wrong that I have to call my telco and I spend an hour on the phone, which is a waste of my time. How much does it cost them to serve me? Whereas if they had the processes that got it right in the first time. So it's from things right down at that level to total waste of human potential, when we've got so many people working in environments where they're not inspired, they're not connected, they're not bringing out their best. They're just doing what they need to do to get through till the end of the day. And that happens at all levels of the organization, not just in sort of more, you know, junior frontline roles. So in my ideal world, everybody would have the opportunity to live to their full potential. And the number one role of leaders would be to bring out the potential in themselves and others.
Wow. Very apt.
That's a nice wrap up, I think. Hey, where can people get more info about your work and read your books? And
so please connect with me on LinkedIn. So it's Corinne Armour at LinkedIn, and my website is www.corinnearmour.com. And my book you can buy on any online bookstore anywhere.
Great. And what's it called again?
The most recent one is called Leaders Who Ask.
And you've got an earlier one too, right?
Yeah, the earlier one's Developing Direct Reports, which is all about the 12 leadership derailers. But that's a whole other conversation.
Wow. Look, we just wanted to say thanks, Corinne, for spending some time with us tonight and having a bit of a conversation about leadership. It's something that we're pretty passionate about from the perspective of what an impact it can have on our community. Being able to bring you into this conversation as a Gippsland girl. And I think I spoke to you last time about this notion of us getting a little side series going about the prodigal children of Gippsland returning. So, you know, we'll wait for you to actually physically relocate to Gippsland and come back into the fold, and then we'll come and tap you on the shoulder to have that conversation.
Fabulous. Thank you very much.
So, James, this idea that leaders need to be vulnerable, that's something that really kind of struck me, because I don't know, maybe I'm stuck in these images of these iconic leaders standing in front of thousands of people and, you know, belting away with these really strong, you know, speeches and imagery of, you know, knowing what the future is going to be and how we're going to get there. And you would never think in any of those situations where those leaders would get up and the first thing that they'd want to demonstrate is vulnerability. That really hit me. I thought, this has to be a new model. It's not the archetypal, you know, old model of a leader standing in front of people on a podium and belting away with this, you know, thundering voice and getting them all motivated and enthused and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, are they? Are they by just channeling their charisma and sort of trying to say the right things, and that is that actually working? Or, you know, when we think of those leaders who have been able to motivate people, you know, and I talked a little bit about Martin Luther King, who for me was decades away from that movement and not even in the main demographic who that was for, but at the same time, he was an individual who struck me as, you know, the reason why he connected was partly because of his own vulnerability. And partly because of the sacrifices that he had made, which made him evidently human. And, you know, that's the same for many great leaders. And you know, here's another more sort of trivial example. But I remember when Barack Obama was first voted into office, and I saw a press conference with him. And he was asked a question by the media. And you kind of expect nowadays that our politicians will throw out a line of spin to try and... you know, make something up. And he turned around and he said, you know what, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm going to get back to you if that's okay. And I was just like, here is one of, you know, he's the most powerful man in the world who has just given an I don't know answer. And my response to that was not, oh my God, this guy's hopeless. Yeah. You know, it was actually, yeah, of course he doesn't. He's been in office for a couple of months, or even if he'd been in office for years, you're thinking, like, this guy's a human being who's managing a superhuman task, who needs to rely on a bunch of people who know other stuff. So yeah, maybe it's going to take him some time to sort of consolidate all that knowledge, bring all that to bear and make a decision. And so, you know, much respect since that happened. So I think that it feels like a paradox, but it's just we're kind of used to seeing leaders who deliver spin.
But I think Corinne kind
no
of...
No one buys it. That's
no, I agree. And, you know, I like the way she said that, especially in Australia. You know, our bullshit detector is on steroids. We can smell bullshit from a mile away. But what I did find interesting was the way she described perhaps the changes in the world, the fact that we are so much more interconnected and that there's new information and new insight and new ideas being generated and communicated and translated around the world so quickly at the moment that even if you were to get up and say, you know, well, I know about this, I know it all, and, you know, trust me and I will lead you through it. I think people realize now that that's not realistic anymore. There's so much new ideas, new information, access to it all that, you know, to stand up in front of people and say, I know everything is even more so impossible today than it was maybe 100 years ago, where, you know, where maybe technology wasn't where it is today.
And if you need evidence of that, just log on to Twitter and you will see all the dissenting voices right there, which actually gives you license to be vulnerable, I think, because you kind of go, well, okay, well, that is impossible. That's an impossibility. So therefore, let's just have a crack at being, you know, and I sort of take vulnerability to mean being truthful, being like, here is our actual situation and here's what we think we can do about it. What do you think? We're not sure we've got all the right answers yet. And as Corinne kind of emphasized through, you know, through our conversation and through her book, asking questions, because God knows there's a lot of great minds in our community who have some great answers. And you know, I don't know, drawing the wisdom of crowds there, and you're going to come up with something.
How about her conversation that she was talking? I think, you know, we're asking her some questions about, you know, an environment that supports leaders, and, you know, how do leaders know that they are leaders, and what are the challenges for them to, you know, to identify that they need to be leaders and walk over that threshold. And I found her description of that really simple and clear.
Yeah, right. The whole, you know, if you are recognizing an opportunity, so you're equipped with the eyes to see the opportunity, therefore you are likely equipped also with the capability to actually rise to that challenge, which I thought is a really interesting idea, because a lot of people at that point may bail out. And I think, you know, having a look across our fair region, is that there's a lot of talent and there's a lot of ideas and a lot of vision, and some people are really sort of manifesting that, and then other people may sort of lack a bit of the self-confidence to really bring all their strength to bear. You know, I love this idea that I can't remember the exact quote from Steve Jobs, but to paraphrase, he was sort of saying like, well, you get to a point where you realize that there are actually no rules, that actually you kind of create the rules. And yeah, like other people have their rules and the world will try and sort of impose some on you, but a lot of those are pretty arbitrary. And so once you realize that, and you realize that you can actually be the co-creator of some new rules, it gives you a new sense of empowerment to kind of go, well, hey, maybe even though I don't know what that's going to look like just yet, that I've seen the opportunity there, that there's a need in the community for some particular like niche to be filled, is enough to sort of propel you into the unknown, which it will be anxiety-ridden sort of unknown territory, and then to start thinking about what could I fill it with?
And I think that anxiety, like we talked about, is natural, and, you know, it's not something to avoid, but maybe, you know, people can have that little Corinne's voice in their head just saying, look, just the fact that you've identified that this is something that there's a gap or that there's a need or an opportunity, that means that you have all of the skills, all of the knowledge, and all of the ability to take it on. So maybe if you're out there and you're thinking, well, gee, I really thought, you know, I thought I should have done that, but maybe I chickened out, you know, the anxiety got to me, that natural anxiety, maybe use it as a mantra, you know, like we can make some t-shirts, James, or something, you know. The fact that you've identified it means you have all the skills and all the knowledge and all the ability to just lead.
That's going to be a big t-shirt, though. We're going to need to shorten that phrase.
Yeah.
But you're dead right. Just let that ring in your mind. And because we know there's vision out there, guys. So bring it to bear. Let's see it.
So, James, this is... what are we up to now? Episode 12, I think. It's been a lot of fun. I'm feeling like... I'm feeling a bit vulnerable, but comfortable in my vulnerability.
Yeah, I never quite get comfortable in this, you know, man. It's like, it's perpetual discomfort, but then you know, feeling pretty excited by our progress so far, and that we're developing a bit of a listenership, and we, you know, really want to, you know, thank you guys for tuning in too.
So. Yeah, and thanks to everybody who, down the street, you know, tap you on the shoulder. I've had a couple of people last week just out of the blue say, hey, you know, well done on the podcast, really enjoying listening to it. So, you know, when we sit here in this glooming studios, banging away, editing away, it's nice to hear some feedback. So, and on that, guys, you can send us your feedback.
Please do
via the interweb. Hit us on our email.
360 feedback.
360.
Bring it on.
That's right. Yeah. We really enjoy feedback. So.
And that just means that we want to hear it through iTunes and Facebook and Instagram.
That's right. So hit us on all the socials. Hit us on our email. You've got all the details. So
at the Gloaming Podcast.
and let us know if there's anything else you think we need to be talking about, because I don't think we're going to run out. We've got a really long list and we've already got some really great suggestions from people out there, but always willing to hear any other ideas that we could take on board and share more stories with you about things that are going on in our community, how we're supporting each other, how we're building resilience, and how we're making Gippsland a wonderful place to live.
Thanks, Ange.
Thanks, James.
Ciao.
Ciao.